Nikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Nikatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cracking open a really big one, Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi.
Yeah, this book is huge. I mean, it's touched so many people, right? Think about George Harrison, Steve Jobs. They all pointed to this.
Exactly. And it's not just some, you know, quaint spiritual memoir. Our mission today is to get under the skin of why it's so, well, radical.
It really is. It basically throws down a gauntlet, challenging that whole idea that spirituality has to be about blind faith.
Right. Yogananda's big claim is that spiritual truth isn't just dogma you accept. It's a tangible, achievable science.
A science of the self. It sounds like a contradiction, but he lays it out.
Yeah, he does. It's positioned not just as his life story, but almost like a manual, a roadmap for the soul, tackling those huge questions. Who am I? Why am I even here?
And maybe, how do I find some real peace or understanding in all this chaos?
Yeah, exactly. The book frames self-realization, that direct connection with, well, the divine or spirit as the ultimate goal. And it gives you a blueprint.
So let's start with the architect himself, the man behind the book.
Okay, let's do that. Paramahansa Yogananda. He was born Mukunda Lal Ghosh back in 1893. Now, him coming to America in 1920, that was a massive deal.
Oh, absolutely. He wasn't just any teacher visiting. He was one of the very first Indian yoga masters to, like, set up shop permanently in the West.
He essentially built the bridge, didn't he? Connecting ancient Eastern wisdom with a modern, often skeptical Western audience.
And his authority, his credentials. Mm. They're pretty unique. It wasn't just about philosophy he'd read. He was a direct disciple of Swami Sri Yukteswar Giri.
And that lineage is key, right? It goes back even further.
Right back to Mahavatar Babaji, this sort of legendary immortal figure. So Yogananda's role wasn't self-appointed. It was seen as being passed down.
Like he was chosen for a specific task?
Pretty much. To reintroduce this ancient science, Kriya Yoga, to the world at a time when maybe it was most needed.
And that's why the autobiography itself is so vital. His life story is the evidence, isn't it?
Exactly. He had to live that bridge. The intense discipline of an Indian ashram meeting the, you know, scientific rational mindset of the West.
Which he did through founding the Self-Realization Fellowship, SRF.
Yeah, making it accessible. A perfect cultural translator, like you said.
Okay, so let's get to the heart of it, the main argument. If you had to boil this whole book down to one core message, what would it be?
Simply put, that the ultimate reason we exist is self-realization.
Meaning?
In the direct, conscious, personal experience of unity between your individual soul and the universal spirit, what he often calls God.
And the how-to for that is Kriya Yoga. That's the central technique he reveals.
Exactly. And he's very clear. This isn't presented as just another belief system you adopt. It's framed as a precise ancient method.
A scientific method, almost, like a spiritual technology.
Sort of, yeah. A technique of meditation designed to basically speed up human evolution towards that divine connection.
The book's scope is just vast. It tackles this perceived split between the material world and the spiritual world head on.
Right. He argues that things we call miracles aren't violations of natural law at all.
They're not God breaking the rules for a special occasion?
No, not according to him. They're expressions of higher, subtler, universal laws. Laws that someone with advanced consciousness can tap into and work with.
So it's all part of the same cosmic rule book, just most of us haven't read the advanced chapters yet.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
And the story itself weaves his personal journey, this intense spiritual seeking from boyhood in India, his tough training, then his mission.
Yeah.
It pulls you in.
It really does. Okay, let's dive into a key part. His time with his guru, Sri Yukteswar Giri. This relationship is central.
The book portrays their meeting as almost predetermined, right? A reunion destined across lifetimes.
Yeah, that's the feeling you get. But the actual training, it wasn't all bliss and chanting, was it?
No, apparently not. Sri Yukteswar comes across as incredibly wise, a master of Jnana Yoga, the path of wisdom, but also really strict.
Definitely. Yogananda talks about his ruthless love. He wasn't about coddling the ego. He used direct, sometimes startling methods to challenge his students.
Like what? Give us an example.
Well, there's a famous story during a cholera epidemic. Sri Yukteswar basically made him confront his fear of death head on to understand deeper laws at play.
Wow. Not your typical lesson plan.
Not at all. Or, you know, apparently summoning Yogananda telepathically just to demonstrate the non-local nature of mind. intense stuff.
And these seemingly miraculous stories, they serve a purpose beyond just being amazing anecdotes.
Absolutely. They lead right into Yogananda's attempt to provide a kind of scientific framework for miracles. He presents these encounters almost like documented case studies.
It's a concept for mastery over subtle energy or prana.
Exactly. He wants to show these aren't myths, but demonstrations of laws we don't fully grasp yet. Evidence that a realized soul can operate beyond typical physical limits.
So give us one of those key case studies.
Okay, how about Giribala, the non-eating saint?
Right, I remember reading about her. Lived for decades without food or water.
Over 50 years, according to Yogananda's account. And he presents this as proof that ultimately, we can draw life energy prana directly from the cosmos, bypassing physical food if we achieve sufficient mastery.
It challenges our most basic assumptions about biology. And the other big example.
Bhadri Mahasaya, the levitating saint. This demonstrates mastery over gravity itself.
Again, pushing the boundaries of what seems possible.
Right. The implication is, if matter is just condensed energy, then a highly evolved consciousness should, theoretically, be able to influence it directly.
So the takeaway isn't that they're magic, but that they're operating by a more complete set of universal rules.
Precisely. And Yogananda saw his mission as translating this for the West, showing these principles weren't just for yogis in caves.
He found examples everywhere, didn't he? Even in America.
Yeah, like his meeting with Luther Burbank, the famous plant breeder.
Burbank, how does he fit in?
Yogananda called him an American saint. He was amazed by Burbank's intuitive ability to communicate with plants, to literally talk them into developing new traits faster than normal.
So Burbank was unconsciously using yogic principles, concentration, attunement with nature's subtle energies.
That's how Yogananda saw it, a practical Western application of the same universal laws.
And then he connects this to someone completely different.
Right, Therese Neumann, the German Catholic mystic, Stigmata. Living only on the Eucharist.
Which seems worlds away from yogic practices.
Exactly. And Yogananda uses her story as powerful evidence for the underlying unity of all true mystical paths. Whether it's Hinduism or Catholicism, the same divine potential can manifest.
That leads us to the climax of the book, really. Something that must have been truly astonishing for readers back then.
Oh, yeah. The reappearance of Triyukteswar after his physical death. Resurrected.
Not just a vision, but a tangible encounter.
That's how it's described. A detailed, profound conversation where Sri Yukteswar apparently gives a full discourse on the afterlife, the nature of astral worlds, how karma works beyond death.
Taking life after death from the realm of faith into, reported experience, that's the book's ultimate audacious claim, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, let's zoom out. What are the core themes someone can take away from this, regardless of their own beliefs? Theme one has to be Kriya Yoga itself.
The scientific path, as you called it.
Yes, it's defined very specifically as a psychophysiological method. It involves particular breathing techniques, pranayama life force control.
What's the mechanism supposed to be?
The idea is it helps decarbonate the blood, superoxygenate it, and then transmute that physical energy into subtle life current within the spine and brain.
And the result?
Accelerated spiritual evolution. Yogananda claimed it allows practitioners to achieve in years what might otherwise take lifetimes of slower development, sort of bypassing the long scenic route.
Like a spiritual shortcut, but one requiring intense discipline.
Definitely requires effort. Okay, theme two, the unity of all true religions.
He really hammers this home, doesn't he?
Tirelessly. Comparing the teachings of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita to Jesus in the Gospels, showing they taught the same core truth. The journey to self-realization. Different packaging, same essential product.
Which links nicely to theme three, karma and reincarnation. But not as punishment, right?
No, not at all. He presents them as rational, impersonal laws. Cause and effect playing out over vast stretches of time across multiple lives.
Giving the soul endless opportunities to learn, grow, and eventually achieve liberation or moksha.
Exactly. And the empowering part is, if you accept this, you're not just a victim of circumstance. Your actions now directly shape your future.
You become a conscious creator of your own destiny, which leads to the final big theme, self-realization as the purpose of life.
Right. The book argues that all are worldly chasing for love, success, pleasure. It's all fundamentally a search, often unconscious, for that ultimate lasting bliss.
The bliss of rediscovering our own true divine nature, the Atman. Everything else is just a temporary substitute.
Pretty much. That's the core argument.
Now, this book isn't just deep. It's incredibly quotable, full of memorable lines. Let's touch on a few key ideas.
Okay. One that really stands out is the true basis of religion is not belief, but intuitive experience.
Meaning you can't just intellectually agree with something. You have to know it deep down through your own experience.
Precisely. It has to become real for you. It shifts spirituality from acceptance to personal verification.
And another powerful one about what holds us back. The power of unfulfilled desires is the root of all man's slavery.
Yeah, that constant wanting, that attachment to getting specific outcomes,
yeah.
That's the source of so much suffering, isn't it?
It points towards the freedom found in acting without being desperately attached to the results. Desireless action, as the Gita calls it.
And maybe one more, but the sheer difficulty of the inner path. You may control a mad elephant, but control of the mind is better and more difficult.
Oof. Yeah, that puts it in perspective. Taming that restless, ego-driven mind. That's the real final frontier.
That inner mastery is the true measure of a yogi, according to this view.
So these are profound ideas, but how does someone listening right now actually apply this in their everyday, often chaotic life?
Good question. Let's make it practical. Application one, taking personal responsibility.
Through understanding karma.
Yeah. If you really take on board that your choices create your future, it shifts your whole mindset. You move from feeling like a victim of circumstances to being the director of your life. It's empowering.
Okay, that makes sense. Application two.
Cultivating emotional resilience. This comes from internalizing the idea of the immortal soul.
The idea that your true self, your essence, can't actually be harmed by external drama or criticism.
Exactly. If you genuinely feel that deep down, it creates this incredible inner security. Fear of failure, fear of what others think, it starts to lose its grip. You become more equanimous.
I like that. And you mentioned balance earlier. That's another application, right?
Definitely. The balanced life. Yogananda used Lahiri Mahasaya as the prime example, a householder yogi.
Showing you don't have to renounce the world and live in a cave.
Not at all. Deep spirituality is compatible with having a job, a family, responsibilities. The key is how you engage with them. With mindfulness, with detachment, doing your duty without being consumed by it.
Performing action in the world, but staying inwardly centered.
That's the ideal. And finally, application four, interfaith understanding.
By focusing on the common ground.
Yes. When you see the same core mystical truth shining through different religions, it helps you look past the surface differences, the rituals, the dogmas, and recognize that universal divine spark in everyone.
Which naturally fosters more compassion and understanding globally.
Hopefully, yes.
Okay, as we wrap up, what's one final thought or maybe a surprise takeaway for you from revisiting this book?
For me, it's still that core radical idea. Spirituality is a personal science. The notion that mystical experience isn't just for the chosen few, but potentially accessible through methodical practice. Yogananda really tried to democratize the path to the divine.
Yeah, that accessibility is powerful. What I find most striking is the complete paradigm shift it proposes.
Also,
it suggests the universe isn't just random matter and energy, but fundamentally conscious, intelligent, and even benevolent. That consciousness is primary. It's an invitation, really, to see ourselves and our potential in a vastly grander way.
A truly unlimited potential. It's quite an invitation.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.